Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We are so lucky to have the diversity of wildlife that we have here in Wisconsin. And really, you know, every change in the season brings a whole new plethora of new things for us to look at and different activities among the wildlife that are kind of here year-round. And always fun to have David Drake and Jamie Knack come by to talk about it. David's a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology. David, great to have you back.
Larry, it's always nice to be with you. Thank you.
And Jamie Knack, thank you for coming. Jamie is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Thank you for coming by.
Not a problem. Happy to be here.
Well, I tell you what, we've got lots of things that we can talk about. And one of the things that I did want to talk about were animals, baby animals, because I think it's worth just mentioning that and getting that. I think most of our listeners, we've done, I think, a pretty good job of educating and informing people over time. But still, there's the person who sees that baby, what, Jamie?
Baby deer? Rabbit, baby squirrel, rabbit. Baby deer, squirrels especially
birds.
At this time, birds, songbirds.
Baby birds.
So, yeah, the Department of Natural Resources kicked off a concerted effort called Keep Wildlife Wild, and it partners with UW-Madison, our Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and also a number of wildlife rehabilitators. And every chance we get in our daily work, we're trying to get these messages out on how to handle baby animals that you might encounter. And this is really the time of year where we have more human-wildlife encounters because animals are having their young and we're more active. The weather's a little nicer and we're out there enjoying the great mm-hmm. outdoors. So what we really want people to do is think before they act. So when you see a baby bunny or you see a baby squirrel, think about the situation, analyze the situation, and then there are a lot of resources that can help you make the decision before you just assume. And again, these are all well-intentioned actions, but before you take that animal into captivity or to a wildlife rehabilitator, chances are, most of the time, these baby animals are doing just what they're supposed to do in nature. But these baby animals are different than human babies in that mother is not always right next to them.
Yep.
So two examples. Baby rabbits, baby bunnies, that mother doe rabbit will make a shallow indentation in a lawn, perhaps, in your backyard. And she will line that nest with leaves or grass or her own fur and have her young. But then she does not tend to them. She doesn't sit on that nest or tend to them regularly. She goes and nurses them early in dawn and dusk. And then for the most part of the day, she's not near them. So if you mow your lawn or come across that nest and you see that she's not there, but you see this nest of presumably helpless babies, you might be tempted to act. And one thing you could do then, instead of acting first, is to take some grass blades or some small twigs and in a crisscross fashion put them across that nest and then leave it for a little while and mm-hmm. come back the next day or 12 hours later and see if they've been moved. You don't want to go and get people and show them and bring dogs
no.
or pets or other humans because you actually leave a scent trail then for predators that can easily find that nest. So it's best to just wait and see and observe and see if those sticks are moved, then you know that they're fine. So another example, right now squirrels are having their babies, so you might come to your backyard and find a squirrel laying on the ground, a young squirrel, eyes are still closed. In that situation, it's likely that it fell out of a nest. And if you can reach that nest and put it back in, go ahead and do that with gloves. If you can't, you can just take a towel that doesn't have, that can't ravel or the strings couldn't get caught in the baby squirrel's nails and just bundle it up next to the base of that tree, and that mother squirrel will come back more than likely and take her young and bring it back up to the nest herself. They often relocate their young to different nests. So I guess the biggest message here is observe, and then the DNR, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website, if you do a keyword search for Keeping Wildlife Wild, they have an excellent website that has resources for you to help learn about these animals, ask questions, and then you can get access to their 1-800 number or a wildlife rehabilitator directory in case an animal truly is sick or injured and you do need to act.
You know, one of the most fun 2 hours I have had in the outdoors was watching a mama squirrel move her three squirrels from one tree 25 feet over to another tree where she had a nest, and they were hanging underneath her, you know, with their kind of their paws around her back, and down the tree she went, and over and up the next tree.
Yeah, and the first time you see it, you kind of wonder, you know, what they're doing. It looks like they're eating their young, right? But they're not. And there's a lot of different theories on why they relocate. So it could have been a disturbance. It could be parasites or...
Well, it was funny because, you know, the squirrel nest, that squirrel nest would just shake violently, you know, and then out she'd come with one. And it was just really a lot of fun to watch. Yeah. I really, really had a good time observing that. Well, you know, and John in Milwaukee, we'll get to you in just a second. I know we got an email from Charles. You can join in, too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. But I wanted to ask David, because we've had some great updates from you over the last couple months about the Fox and Coyote Project, which garnered a lot of interest among our listeners. So it was really a lot of fun. And I know you're sort of winding things up in a way. Tell us what's the status right now.
All right. We sure will. Yes, we have had a tremendous amount of public interest in this. And we have a Facebook page if you want to go visit our progress and update yourself on our progress. It's UW Urban Canid Project, and you can just search that on Facebook. We're on Twitter as well. And so Marcus Mueller, my graduate student, has located a den here on campus, and he had a trail camera up, and so we've got pictures up of the fox pups here as well. And so that's been kind of neat. We have kind of transitioned into a different phase of the project. We've for the most part ended trapping for this season, because we've got enough animals on the air right now, and we're going to probably trap animals as we need to replace them and things like that.
And for those who are just listening, you were trapping them, and then...
Yep, so we're live trapping them using a cable restraint, and then we're assessing their health. We're drawing blood on them and swabbing various orifices to assess the health of the animal. And ultimately, we're putting a radio collar on each
animal.
And then
releasing.
And then we release them, that's right, and then we track them around. And so we've been trapping animals on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, but we also, for the last couple of months, have been trapping animals in people's yards. And so we caught a fox, for example, in somebody's front yard in West Madison, and we caught a big 36-pound male coyote in somebody's backyard just south of the Beltline off of Rimrock Road. And so there's another opportunity for us to involve the public, and it's been wonderful. And so if you go to our Facebook page also, we've got some maps up showing the locations of these animals periodically as they move around the city and things like that. So it's been a very, very rewarding project. I bet you we've had at least 150 different people come out with us checking traps and going on tracking the animals and things like that. And so we're now moving into we've stopped trapping for a little bit of time. We're moving into full-blown tracking the animals around. And ultimately, again, we're trying to figure out where these animals are moving within the city of Madison. And we're trying
to be really cool.
It is. It's a pretty neat project and on a whole bunch of different levels. We're looking at competition between these two species. You know, in the wild, out in the country, if a coyote comes across a fox, typically it will kill that animal because it sees it as a competitor. We don't think that competition is as rampant or as strong here in the urban area because there's so many resources for these animals that they don't have to necessarily compete for them. I mean, just think about all the squirrels we were just talking about, or the rabbits or something like that. And one sad piece of information is just yesterday, one of our male foxes, the one that bred the vixen, or the female that has the pups here on campus, he just got hit and killed by a car on University Avenue. But that's we saw the same thing happen last year, and that's going to be probably the number one source of mortality for these animals in the urban area is vehicles. And right now, because they're trying to feed those extra mouths at the den site, that they're traveling greater distances and they're a little bit more active than they typically would be to try to keep bringing food back to the den. And so we just put a message up on our Facebook page, again, because we've got a lot of animals on the landscape now with breeding season going on and birthing season going on, that as you're driving around, just be aware. Maybe drive a little bit slower, kind of be vigilant, and if you can, brake for animals, as they say on the bumper sticker. But it's been a phenomenal project, and again, if the public wants to get involved, go to our Facebook page, and we've got a way for you to contact us, and we'd love for you to come out and see what we're doing.
And again, the Facebook page title is?
It's UW Urban Canid, which is C as in Charlie, A-N-I-D as in Delta, Project. So UW Urban Canid Project.
And I think, Cheyenne can check this, I think we have a link up on our Facebook page, too, So at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, in case you didn't get that, go to our Facebook page. We'll have a link up there.
That'd be great. But thank you for the opportunity to update everybody.
Yeah, that's a very, very cool thing. John in Milwaukee has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was looking for some help identifying some turtles. Several days ago, I was in a park along the Milwaukee River in Mequon, Villa Grove Park, and there's this little bay area, and I spotted a turtle, and it was across the river. I had binoculars, and so I tried to take a good look at it, but it was too small for me to identify. Then I start looking around, and I realize, oh, there's another turtle and another, and I ended up counting 24 turtles basking in the sun, all in one area of the Milwaukee River. I got online and tried to identify what kind of turtle they were, but AI was too far away to really get a good look at, you know, face and any kind of coloration on the skin. All I can tell you is that the shell was very rounded front to back and side to side. It was
could you be a little more descriptive?
what do you think it might have been?
Most likely, I'm going to wage a guess that it's probably a painted turtle. And okay. We've got a good variety of turtles in Wisconsin, from the smallest being the musk turtle, or sometimes it's called a stink pot turtle, to the largest being a snapping turtle. But the most common turtle species in Wisconsin by far is the painted turtle. And those are the ones that you typically would see out in more of a still water or a slow-moving current water type area, up on logs or rocks basking. And typically, if you look at them, they've got a rounded shell, as you correctly identified. And then they the reason they call them painted turtles is where the top shell and the bottom shell meet. It looks like somebody took orange crayon or orange paint and painted the edge of the turtle. And so that's why they call them painted turtles. But then also, if you look at the neck, you'll see these yellow vertical stripes going up the neck. And so turtles are starting to come out of hibernation, and a lot of times they'll just burrow into the mud at the bottom of the river body or lake and ride out the winter. And so now that it's starting to get nice, the ice has come off the water, that they're starting to get active again because the water temperature is starting to heat up.
That would be a positive ID, because I did see a bold streak of red towards the front. Underneath, but I was too far away to see any detail in the head and neck.
Yeah, so the other thing, maybe, John, I would just, if you want to follow this up a little bit, is maybe go to internet search engine and just type in, you know, painted turtle in Wisconsin and look at an image and see what you find there. But I'm guessing that's probably what it was.
I would think so. Thanks a lot, John, for calling.
Point I'd like to make.
What's that?
That's another point I'd like to make. I really wish a lot of the wildlife ID sites had better pictures, because all I needed was a profile to see the shape of the shell, and all the pictures were from above. And I don't see the dimensions, the depth of the shell. And I'm a photography person, so.
Yeah, John, I tell you what, there is, I think, one booklet that you're going to like, if that's the case.
Yeah, so the Department of Natural Resources has a three-booklet series on the herpetiles, so the reptiles and amphibians of Wisconsin. And what's really nice is, instead of picking up a Peterson's field guide of the eastern U.S. and the herpetiles, you can narrow it down to just Wisconsin species. So if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and type in turtles and lizards of Wisconsin, that will get you to that book, and there is ordering information, but you can actually order all three. There's one of snakes of Wisconsin and amphibians of Wisconsin as well, and they're $10 for the set. So that might be a resource that you're interested in having.
For $10. Yeah, you bet. That's well worth it. That's for sure.
Thanks for the question, John.
Appreciate it. David in Wisconsin, somewhere in Wisconsin. Hi, thanks for...
You're welcome. I have a question. I was in Madison yesterday and leaning by the Habitat Rehab store near on Odana Road, and behind a piece of wood laying up against the wall was half a rabbit. Literally, it looked like somebody had taken a knife and cut it along the backbone and removed half the rabbit from the front legs to the back legs. Now, the intestinal pouch was laying alongside of it and hadn't been broken, I don't think. It didn't look like it was broken. But half the rabbit was gone, and the other half looked like it was hidden.
All right. Well, let's, Jamie, what are we looking at there?
So David, rabbits are a fairly common prey item, and they're a fairly easy animal to kill. They have a pretty thin skinned, and there are both animals that are active during the day and nocturnal that will take a rabbit. So there are a number of possibilities here, and we can't really discount, you know, just even a domestic dog as a potential predator. So for the nighttime, it's possible fox and coyotes that David's referring to and doing research on, they certainly have been bringing back plenty of fox or plenty of rabbits and squirrels to the den sites right now. So that's a possibility. Also owls and red-tailed hawks. So again, these are animals that are pretty common in the cities right now, and lots of predators have keyed in on them. So we would just be guessing, but those are at least some of them.
Yeah.
And what may have happened, so typically with owls is they just remove the head and leave the body. But what may have happened, David, is you saw a kill, and maybe the animal was starting to eat the rabbit and then got scared off, and it will probably come back. So I'm guessing maybe if you – I know you're out of town, but if you were to go back to the restore today, that rabbit carcass probably will be gone.
I mean, it's possible the owl killed it and – you know, did what it was going to do, and the rest of the carcass was dragged off by something else. So a lot of times there's more than one individual or species involved.
Yeah. I've told this story.
What animal am I feeding my backyard pond fish to? He's eating my fish.
Snapping turtle, potentially.
How big is it, a landscape pond, or is it a larger pond?
It's got about 400 gallons in it. It's not very big. It's a waterfall.
In that case, it probably could be turtles possibly could get in there, but more likely it could be raccoons or great blue herons possibly, or some kind of a fish-eating bird.
Yeah. So they'll come right in your backyard.
The easiest thing to do with that is to take take some kind of a netting, mesh netting, and secure it over the pond so that nothing can get in there.
Create a wire grid over the top of it so you prevent aerial and land animals from getting access, they can still get air.
Or you can just keep buying fish.
You're right.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling, David. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Lynn and Eau Claire up next. Lynn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Excellent program, as usual.
Thank you.
I would like to, remind all the wildlife lovers out there to remember the little tiny critters, our bees and our butterflies, our apex pollinators, and most folks are aware of the critical situation that our monarchs are in, and to encourage people to plant accordingly. Clover is not evil. It's lovely. And we actually seed our lawn with clover. Because the little things count, too. They count a lot.
That's exactly right. I have some clover in my lawn, and I certainly do. I'm glad to see it there.
Yeah, we're always trying to encourage people to just reduce the amount of lawn that they have. So whether that's planting clover or native grasses, other native trees and shrubs, and just mowing less and having more habitat for the little creatures.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. Appreciate the call. Yeah, I'm going to... There's a couple of butterfly-friendly plants that I haven't put in yet. I've got some, but I'm going to put some more in this spring.
Yeah, and there's some great resources for that now, too.
Yeah, there really are.
Some really wonderful publications.
Yep. The other thing you can do for butterflies in particular, if you want, is shallow pools of water with either a small pebble base or a sandy base, and they'll come in and lay eggs in that area, and as well as use the water for drinking. So there's a lot of attention being paid to, especially the butterflies, because that marries well with hummingbirds, and a lot of the practices for both hummingbirds and butterflies are beneficial for both.
We are talking about the world of wildlife today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. Again, join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Miller. Birthday girl, Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today, and we're happy to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about Wisconsin's wildlife with Jamie Nack and David Drake of the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. So happy to have them here. And Marie and Jefferson, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I live in Jefferson on a farm, and within the last couple weeks, I want to say, I was driving up our driveway, which comes through a wooded area, and I saw a very large white bird take off from one of the trees, and I couldn't stop fast enough to watch it further, but I'm wondering if that could have been a white owl.
Snowy owl?
I would love to know that.
You know, Marie, so are you in that wooded area? Is it primarily woods, or is the wooded area surrounded by a bunch of open fields or open land?
Open fields and open land.
Yeah, so
also some ponds.
Yeah, it's possible, because snowy owls are, of all the owl species, you're more likely to see them during the day than you are at nighttime, so they're more of a diurnal owl relative to a lot of our nocturnal owls here in the state.
Uh-huh.
But they are also a very much an open land creature, and so they you find them out where you have farm fields or prairies or something of that nature. So it is possible. You know, the other issue is we're getting a little bit late into the winter here, and most of those owls have started pushing north again to get back up into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that is something. You know, we do have occasionally mutated variations or the pelage of red-tailed hawks, for example, or something like that. So it could have been an albinistic or a piebald, what's called a piebald, which is a white coat but not truly albino animal. It could be something like that as well.
Okay. Mm. Well, it was very exciting.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty neat.
Definitely. Very, very neat. Thanks for calling, Marie. Appreciate it very much. Tamar in Columbia County, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I live on some acreage in Columbia County with a beautiful creek flowing through it, and we have some lovely, lovely old oak trees and some beautiful willow trees, and we also have some very happy beavers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been trying to coexist with them. We love seeing them. We've been wrapping the bases of our trees, but you know, this morning I was drinking my coffee and looking out the window, and there was just a big beaver just trotting all around, happy as a clam. And so I want to know from your guests what I've done a little bit of research on the idea of relocating them, but I don't know. You know, I want to do what's right for the animals and try to live with them, coexist with them. What are your thoughts?
Well, that is a good question, and beavers are a very, very interesting species for a whole bunch of reasons. Number one, I'll just give you a little background here. So when our country was settled by the Europeans, beavers were one of the mainstays of our economy. And so, you know, nowadays I always make a joke if somebody's really rich. I always say, well, you've got Oprah money. You know, back then, if somebody was really rich, they literally said they've got, you know, they're beaver rich, because they either had enough money to buy beaver pelts, which kept people warm, or they made their money from trading in beaver pelts and things like that. So since that, we've almost decimated beavers during the course of our history here in America. And now beavers have been on the upswing for the last several decades for sure. And they're the largest rodent in North America. So they're a pretty prolific breeder, like most of our rodents are. So to get to your question, if you wanted to lethally control these animals to kill them, you would be legal to do that on property you own at any time of the year that damage is occurring. And I will let you wrestle with your conscience as to whether or not you want to kill these animals. But if you do decide to do that, you're not in any way going to hurt the overall beaver population, because they're healthy in terms of numbers of their population, and they're a prolific breeder, like I said, and they'll replace those animals someplace else. So you can do that, and you'd be legal to do that if you wish to. If you want to try to coexist, what you're doing with wrapping the trees that you want to protect is the right way to go about it. Perhaps you sacrifice some trees. You know, beavers are obviously the nature's engineer, and they create a tremendous amount of good wildlife habitat for other species when they dam up water. And if you or your husband or somebody on your property is a waterfowl hunter, you know, beavers are a great thing, because they produce this phenomenal reservoir that draws in a lot of waterfowl for hunting. There's a lot of other animals that use it. So if you can coexist with them, that's certainly an option. And if you don't mind them taking some trees and you save other trees, then go ahead and do that. In terms of relocating them, that's going to be a little bit more problematic. And there are live traps out there. They're called suitcase traps. And you can, or you can find somebody perhaps to live trap the beaver. But where do you put it is the problem.
Yeah, it's the problem.
And in Wisconsin, you cannot relocate an animal on property you don't own without that property owner's permission. So you may have a little bit of a tough time finding somebody willing to take your beavers. You can ask around neighboring landowners and things like that if you want to, but I think your options come down to either lethally removing these animals and tearing down the dam, or trying to, as you said, peacefully coexist and just tolerate whatever damage that they are creating.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, what about relocating them to public land?
Nope.
It's the same type of thing as on the, you know, most public lands have their own beavers, and they most likely don't want yours. So
yeah,
that's the problem, is that where do you put the animal? That again, they're a pretty common species on the landscape in Wisconsin, and to find a place where there aren't beavers but there's suitable beaver habitat would be a bit of a problem.
Well, and so do they at some point move to new territory, or once they've found a place they're happy, do they stay, or what?
Yeah, they'll stay there as long as the habitat's there, and they've got the den and the lodge and things like that, and they're a kind of a social species like most rodents are. So they will, as long as they're content and happy there, they'll stay there for the duration of their life.
Yep.
Uh-huh, okay. Well, I surely don't have the heart to lethally remove them, so we'll just have to keep on.
Yeah. Well, maybe you've got a new swimming pool.
Yeah. There you go. And sometimes, you know, when those dams, that water gets over onto other people's property.
Yeah.
You cause flooding issues. It can be a real issue in counties that have issues with culverts, if they dam up a culvert on a road. So they'll actually go in those situations where they're causing infrastructure damage or a flooding issue, and they'll blow up the dams or displace the dams so that hopefully the beavers will move on. So,
yeah. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Bob and Krivitz next. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. The address you gave for the picking up that set of books. Do you have? I'm at my cabin. I do not have a computer up here. Is there a telephone number? Because I'd like to order a couple sets of these today for my grandkids.
Yeah, Bob, I'm sorry. I really don't have a number in front of me. And if I even look in the cover, I happen to have the set of books with me today. I'm not sure that that'll be the correct number. So really the best opportunity or the best way to do this is to go to the DNR's website, and in the keyword search, just type in Herp Tiles of Wisconsin, and you'll get to a order form that you can just print out and order however many sets you want and put it in the mail. But yeah, I apologize. I don't have a number to help you directly.
We might be able to find it. Stay listening. Cheyenne might be able to find
that. You could probably call the general service number, but I don't know that they'll, you know, complete that form for you. So
the other opportunity, Bob, is possibly going to your local service center, the DNR service center.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to say. There are many service
potentially
centers.
Potentially.
Yeah. And if they don't have them in stock there, they at least could point you in the right direction.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. We have other callers online. Ann in Madison, I believe, up next. Hi, Ann. Thanks for calling.
Oh, sure. I have a yard that used to be a great America for squirrels, because there was a huge old black walnut tree next door, and it was cut down. But we still have quite a few squirrels hanging around, and I was wondering, I know the squirrels like to live in gutters that have leaves in them during the winter, but do they also build their nests for their young in people's gutters? And if so, should I avoid cleaning out the gutters so I don't disturb the nest?
Ann, I have not heard of that before, squirrels nesting in gutters or using the leaves in gutters, and I certainly would not delay removing the material in your gutters, because that's potentially going to cause you some more homeowner repairs and issues on your house. So, but what you could do is, squirrels do nest in trees, they make leaf nests, but they also will take up artificial nest boxes, and there are specific designs of nest boxes for our tree squirrels. So if you did some looking on the internet, on some reputable sources on building nest boxes for squirrels, and we have an extension publication on houses and feeders that's on the UW Extension Learning Store's website, and there would be a diagram there where you could build your own squirrel boxes, and that would be a replacement for that fallen walnut tree that you talked about. It's just putting up some nest boxes and see if they'll take those over.
Thanks a lot for calling. And my recollection is that they're not all that difficult to build.
No, they're pretty
easy to build.
Yeah, so. Just a little bit larger than your standard
birdhouse.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mary Mack in Madison. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, see, I have an animal I've been trying to identify for the past week and a half.
Okay.
10:30 at night, I let my dog out. I'm out on the back deck. You know, watching her, because we got coyotes in that in the area. I live over by Cherokee Marsh. And I heard a noise. I looked to my right, and it looked like this huge gray bat. It came down, wasn't very coordinated, landed on the side of a tree. And it had wings like a bat. They folded down. There's no tail. And it ran up that tree faster than you could think straight.
I know what that is.
Go ahead, Larry. You answer. You take this one, Larry.
No, I think it might have been a flying squirrel.
Yeah,
I
agree. Absolutely.
I agree. And they do have a tail, but they have a patagium that attaches from their wrist, you know, essentially their front feet to their back feet. And they don't truly fly. They glide. So they'll climb up a large tree and glide to another tree. But they'll certainly...
Yeah, but this thing was huge. I mean, it was the size of like a sparrowhawk.
Yeah, huge is relative.
But that's, and especially flying squirrels.
Especially when they're stretched out gliding, they look bigger than they really are.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah,
I definitely think that's. Yep, I would agree.
It's not typical. Our bats are not on the ground. They're not walking on the ground. They're not climbing up trees. We have bats that roost in trees, but not. Moving along them. They land and, scurry under the bark. Yeah.
The tree and ran up it so fast. It was
That is very typical of the flying squirrels. So they're likely to be at the base of the tree, run up it.
And there's a lot of them.
There are. I was going to just say that although we don't see them very often because they're nocturnal animals, they're very common. And we have both southern and northern flying squirrels in Wisconsin. And the southern flying squirrel is by far the most common of them all, and it is really, really cool to see them.
So they rely a lot on, they need dead trees. They need snags and cavities like we just talked about the other tree squirrels. So if you have dead trees, keep them standing. Don't cut them down for firewood. We want to preserve those because they're excellent habitat, especially for those animals like flying squirrels. So,
thanks, Mary. I appreciate the call. I want to give Robin LaCrosse a chance to join us. Rob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for the show. I love your show. I'm a hunter, and I feel a little ridiculous asking this question because I probably should know. But
are you using your real name?
Yeah. I have a picture of this doe on one of my trail cameras. I'm pretty certain it's a doe, but anyway. Her face is really swollen. I mean, really swollen. And so is her neck, but down towards the bottom of her neck where her brisket would be, it's back to, what should be normal. And I was just wondering what that might be.
Mm.
So, Rob, there are a lot of different diseases that deer can get. So that doesn't, to me, seem like any of the symptoms we would see with chronic wasting disease or epizootic hemorrhagic disease or some of the, more common ones that we hear about. But sometimes they get tumors, they get growths on the outside of their face. She very well could have potentially been hit by a car, and she's got a broken jaw and some abscesses and is healing, and you're seeing some of that. There's a lot of different things that it could be. As far as your question about kind of what do you do about it, if you're seeing her regularly and she seems to be in the same location and is really not functioning well health-wise, I would call the DNR Service Center and ask them for some assistance on what they want you to do. So we're not in a hunting season, so that does not play in. We don't have the ability as a landowner to, you know, harvest that animal because of its, you have to be authorized. And at this point, you know, we're talking about authorization from a conservation warden. So if you're seeing her a lot and you're concerned, I'd call the customer center, call center, and ask them to hook you up with the local biologist or the law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
If you want that number, it's 1-888-936-7463.
1-800, is it?
1-888.
Oh, 888.
Yep, 936-7463. And that acronym, it's 1-888-WDNR-INFO.
And the other option is just let nature play out and see what happens, because even though that animal is maybe not doing well, something will find it and feed on it. And
You might not see it again, and it's just moved on and it's functioning. But if you do happen to see it lingering and it's really, you know, staying in the same place, then I wouldn't be afraid to make that call.
Yep. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. We have an email from Charles. I have a very small pond in the past. I've always had spring frogs singing by this time. This year I've noticed absolutely no frogs at all. The neighbors across the road have frogs in their water. Are frogs in decline, or do frogs go in circles? I have noticed turtles are doing fine.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that he meant cycles.
Cycles,
yeah. So frogs are emerging, just as David was talking about the turtles, and we know tiger salamanders are out in the Madison area because David's been watching them cross the road by his house. But we've noticed in our neighborhood chorus frogs, spring peepers, and wood frogs are all calling, but we're in the southern part of the state, so as you move further north, it might be a little slower progress with that calling. So I wouldn't give up hope yet, and just because you don't have them right now singing, they just might have preferred a different pond. There might be not be the water temperatures or the right environment this year that they've just chosen your neighbor's pond or a different location. So I wouldn't be too alarmed. We're not hearing anything about declines or reports out of the ordinary.
Austin in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. So I have a question in regards to robin migration. It's always been something that is considered a sign of spring, the return of the robin.
Yep.
I mean, but the past couple of years, I've always noticed robins at my feeder in very few numbers, always looking very drab. Do you have an explanation for this?
Austin, that's a very good question, and even though we do consider robins traditionally more of a migratory species, they can also be what's called an eruptive species, and that means that they don't always migrate out of our area, especially if we have more mild winters, or, as you've noted, if there's a food source here that they can capitalize on over the course of the winter, like a feeder, that they may stick around for the winter. And there's a couple of advantages to them leaving the winter, because obviously as you go south, the weather warms up and they don't have to spend as much time or as much energy keeping warm as they do up here in the northern climates. But if they're able to survive the northern climate, they also don't have to expend energy to migrate south and then come back north during the breeding season. And migration is no picnic for a lot of these animals, that even though they are going to warmer climates, that depending on what the bird species are, you know, a decent percentage of a species may die during migration, because it's a hazardous journey. So that's part of it. They've got to expend energy. But the other thing is, if you stay up here and once the weather and the winter releases, then you've got your pick of some of the best breeding territories here, because you can get on the breeding territory before some of your compatriots do come up as they're coming up for migration. So there are some benefits to trying to ride out the winter here as a somewhat migratory species like robins are.
You know what's really fun this time of the year? I love it. I do a jog. I try to do like a 5K in the mornings, and this time of year with all the bird songs, but the leaves aren't on the trees yet, so you can really see like cardinals.
Yeah.
We have a huge number of cardinals in our neighborhood, and it's really fun. And usually they're up on the top of the tree, singing their hearts out, and so this is a great time to see those birds.
It is, absolutely. We've seen bluebirds back now, phoebes, Rufuside Towhee just got listed on our phenology list in our department. Woodcock are painting. You know, yellow rump warblers and palm warblers are some of the earliest warbler species returning. They should be up here pretty soon. And so spring is coming.
Good time.
Yeah, it really is.
Talking today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When you phone in at 1-800-642-1234, our birthday girl, Cheyenne Lentz, will, happy birthday, by the way, she'll answer the phone in her nice, friendly way and put you right on, put you right through to us. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Thomas in Manitowoc, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, wanted to know, a relative of mine had a bat in their house around the Christmas holidays. It was a real cold day, maybe 10 degrees or so. And I wanted to rescue it, but they caught it before I got there and they let it back outside. And I said, well, that's going to be a dead bat for sure. How can you rescue a bat in the wintertime when it's really cold, when it's ought to be in hibernation in an instance like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting situation, because typically they are hibernating, and, you know, it's possible that they were in... do you have any knowledge if they might have bats in the attic of that home?
No, that was the first one they ever had in their house, and then they called an exterminator, and he told them, well, you don't really have any bats in your house. He looked it all over, and he told them it must have flew in the door when they opened the house. And I said, well, that'd be impossible.
Yeah, typically, I mean, bats are in a home when they're in the attic and they're using that as a summer roost or to overwinter, or occasionally bats find their way into the living quarters or the lower levels of a home through an open screen, a torn screen, in older homes, cracks and crevices that they might find their way in. And typically in warmer weather, when they are out and about, so from April to October, you would catch that bat using a box, trapping it against the wall, and just remove it and put it outside and try to seal up any windows and things like that. In the case of winter, that's a tough situation. There are some people that will overwinter bats, but they are going to be specialists that are accustomed to dealing with the species, and I don't even know honestly how they do it. But our Department of Natural Resources has a wonderful bat ecologist team that you can contact them through their website. And they might be able to better handle that situation if that occurs in the future. It's possible that bat will move off and, go back to where it was, that it inadvertently got into there and couldn't get its way out. But it's hard to say what caused it to stir to begin with, because typically they would be overwintering.
Yeah, definitely.
Our colleague and good friend Scott Craven, I've heard him say in the past, and so I'm going to blame him if this answer is not appropriate and the DNR calls in. But Scott has commented on this in the past, that if you find a bat in your house in the winter, to put it into a styrofoam container and then put that container into the refrigerator for the winter, because that kind of mimics those conditions that they're hibernating in anyway. And then once it gets to be nice in the spring, you know, maybe next week when we're going to get up in the 60s or so, let the bat outside and it will find its way that way. And it is unusual to find bats in your house in the winter. It is possible that maybe it got disturbed if they went up into the attic and were rooting around for boxes. Or so typically if people are doing remodeling construction in their house and they've got bats in the attics, the bats will get disturbed at that point. But like Jamie said, it would be very unusual for a bat to be awake in the winter here.
And I guess I take this opportunity, there's to plug another event coming up, but also with bats, if you do have bats in your home, we're at a point right now where you could be excluding them. So it's a method with one-way doors that allows them to leave the house without returning. It's detailed very well through either the Bat Conservation International website or, again, the Department of Natural Resources state website on how to exclude bats or evict them from your home without harming them. It's important to note that our four cave bat species are now threatened status because of the threat of white nose syndrome that's killing bats across the country. So there are more protections on them right now. So,
mm-hmm.
anyway, but right now is a good time to evict them or into October. But from the period of June 1st through August 15th, you may not evict bats. And the reason is the females are having their young, and their young are flightless. She comes back and nurses them. So during that time, if you were to evict the adults, you'd essentially kill the young. So because of their protections, again, as a threatened species, from June 1st until August 15th, you may not evict bats. So you have a window right now if you're dealing with bats from the winter as they're emerging, and then also into fall before winter to deal with that situation.
There we go. Wendy in Menasha has a comment for us. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. I actually have a couple things. One's about bunnies and one's about the beavers. You had mentioned earlier about putting twigs or something over a rabbit's nest. That is a really bad idea because if a doe smells human, she will come and kill those babies. And even domesticated rabbits will do that because I had a female that had babies in a pen at home, and when I went in to change her food and water, I came back a couple hours later and those babies were dead. They will kill them if they smell any human. So if you find a baby nest of rabbits, stay as far away from it as possible. And then the lady with the beavers, as much as I hate to say this, there are local clubs that are trapping clubs. So she may want to get a hold of one of those trapping clubs. They could come in and set some traps, and at least then the beaver pelts will be used for something instead of just killing the poor things off. So those were my comments.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Jamie, comment?
Yeah, I'll just comment. You know, from the rabbit standpoint, that's something that, you know, we've worked with within this campaign of Keep Wildlife Wild, with wildlife rehabilitators and so on. So this is an effort for the public to be able to identify whether that nest is being visited and taken care of. And you're absolutely right. We don't want people continuing to come up to that nest. But I'm not sure that the literature supports that the doe is going to kill the young with human scent. There's also, you know, a myth with baby birds, too, that if you pick up a baby bird and touch it and put it back in, say, a robin's nest, that mother's not going to come back. And certainly most birds don't have a very well-developed sense of smell, and that is really a myth that we have pushed forward. And then as far as the beaver situation, as a landowner, you have the provision year-round to control beavers on your property, but you can also designate somebody to do that for mm-hmm. that work for you. So whether that's
so that's a good point.
Wildlife services, or it could be somebody else, and you have to provide written permission to do that. But yeah, I don't think it wasn't brought up, but you know, the intention, if that animal were to be harvested, it would be utilized, right?
Yeah, a good resource if you want to look for trappers is the Wisconsin Trapping Association. Yeah. You can just Google that. And you do, obviously, you know, one of the tenets of this North American model that we always talk about, and you can Google that as well if you're not familiar with it, but is that you, if you harvest an animal, you always use that animal for a purpose. And the problem with harvesting beavers right now is their coat is not in prime pelt. And so even though they would trap it, they probably would not harvest it for the fur, because that fur is not going to be, it's not going to be a high quality fur. Like it would be in the wintertime. But you can still trap that animal out, and the purpose would be that you're trying to alleviate a conflict between on the landscape with that animal.
But there's still, you know, there's the potential for the meat to be yep. utilized both either for humans yep. consumption or for dogs.
And the castor gland is very useful.
And the skull is an awesome yep. teaching tool.
Absolutely. So there's other purposes. That's right.
I remember a beaver skull from my grade school days at the Hope Grade School.
No.
And Mrs. Dahl, the teacher, would pull those teeth out
yeah.
and talk about how they had to keep wearing
yeah.
that down.
Or
because
they continue
kept
to grow.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. The characteristic of being a rodent is those incisors continually grow when they're awake and active.
Jeff in La Crosse. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hey, a comment in what I observed. I was at a dog park where I saw what I thought was two peregrine falcons knock a pigeon out of the air, but it didn't kill it, and it landed in the dog park. So I picked up the pigeon and got it out of there because I didn't want the dog to eat it. But I was just wondering, I believe that there's peregrines that nest downtown, but do they migrate south, and do they hunt in pairs like that?
Yeah, so peregrines are just an awesome bird for a whole host of reasons. But one of the things is they're the fastest animal on land, and they've been clocked in their dives as much as 175 miles an hour. So that's a pretty quick bird. And if you're a pigeon flying along in your own way, and all of a sudden you get hit by a peregrine falcon, it's not a very good day for you. But peregrine falcons, the other thing about them is they were one of the raptor species that were susceptible to DDT. And for a while back in the 60s and 70s, that their populations declined pretty precipitously. They have come back, and yes, they are in cities pretty commonly because those cities are very similar to what they would find and what they would use in more of a native habitat, where they will utilize rocky cliff faces and rocky ledges for nesting and things like that and perching. And so those skyscrapers, or those tall buildings we have in cities, are a very good replicate of that natural habitat that they would typically use. They typically will not migrate. And if they do, it's just short distance migration, and they're probably breeding right now. So that's probably why you're seeing them in pairs.
Very.
Okay. Yeah. It was just kind of interesting, but they were pretty upset when I didn't want the pigeon was alive still when it knocked it down. I just threw it over the fence and it got into trees, and it kind of hung around for a little bit, but then they flew off.
Yeah, you took their dinner from them.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Jeff, for calling. Why, email from Scott, why do owls just take the rabbit's heads or the animal's heads? Do we have any idea why?
I don't know this for I haven't studied the literature on this, but I'm assuming it's because that brain is very high in protein. It's a very good source of nutrition. And so they're primarily looking for that. But the other issue is, depending on how big the animals that they've eaten, that they may not be able to actually carry it in their talons and fly away with it. And so a lot of times we'll see owls hit on the roadways because they're actually, after they've pounced on the animal crossing the road, they'll actually sit there on the road and feed on the animal, and they get hit because they're distracted from the feeding. And so, for them to get the head, it's easy for them to carry off, and that is one of the more nutritious, the brain is one of the more nutritious parts of the body.
Talking about the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Nack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Forest and Wildlife Ecology Specialist Jamie Nack and David Drake. Glad to have them along. And certainly, thank you for listening in. Questions, call us at 800-642-1234. Or you can post, maybe you've got a photo or a question, post it on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page for that. And I wanted to bring up the project that's called the Wisconsin Coverts Project with you too, because, you know, landowners are such an important part of our conservation effort, and this Coverts Project is a great resource, isn't that, Jamie?
It is. So, and this is going to be kind of a self-pitch here. So this is a project that I coordinate for the state. David Drake is a guest speaker for and helps with field trips. Scott Craven is also involved as the chief cook and also a lecturer for a number of topics. So this is a program that is organized and delivered through the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology Extension Specialists. And it's a partnership with a number of sponsors. Our longstanding sponsor has been the Ruff Grouse Society. But the program itself is open to landowners who are, so private properties, private landowners who are interested in managing their woodland habitat for wildlife. We'll also take absentee landowners or Minnesota, Michigan, kind of the states surrounding Wisconsin landowners that are interested in coming. So it's held in August every year. We've been doing the workshop since 1994. It begins on a Thursday afternoon and runs through noon on Sunday. The workshops are held at Kemp Natural Resources Station, which is one of UW-Madison's agricultural research stations. It's a really rough place to stay.
Yeah.
We're on beautiful Lake Tomahawk on a peninsula with about 136 acres that Kemp owns, and it's just a fabulous facility. The workshop focus then is to provide information on forest and wildlife management, presented as educational, giving you options on what species you might want to manage for and how to go about it. So we see we'll have lots of guest lectures or guest speakers, both from the forestry and wildlife profession, and then some outstanding field trips that gets you out into the woods and looks at some of these techniques. So it's an application process, and in terms of the application, we're looking for folks who own at least 10 acres, but also have an outreach component. So this is a true train the trainer type workshop. We're looking for people who are committed and engaged in their community, that if we get them through this workshop, they're going to do good things on their property, but they're going to share some of these key messages with others. They might hold one-on-one conversations or actually host a field tour on their property. So if you're interested, I believe Larry or Judith will get this up on the Facebook page with a link to the Wisconsin Coverts Project website, where you'll find an application. You can also look at last year's agenda to get an idea of the topics. But I'll tell you, we cover not just deer and turkeys and rough grouse. We also talk about small mammals, reptiles and amphibians, and so on. So really cover the taxa.
And the cost on it is?
If you're selected, it's free, thanks to our wonderful sponsors and some grants that we've written. So it's a really good deal.
And
applications are due June 15th. Every year, June 15th is the application deadline. So,
you know, a friend of mine, Kurt Westbrook, took this a few years back, and he just absolutely loved it. And I know he's done a lot of outreach work.
Yeah. Yeah, we really have some fun. You end up, you know, what we call our participants, our Coverts Cooperators, and we reach out to them on an annual basis to help us recruit for the following years. And we receive some really wonderful updates and emails and thanks. And most of the folks that go through the workshop tell us when we're saying goodbye on Sunday that they wish they would have taken this a long time ago.
Yeah.
And really appreciated the learning opportunity.
It's a tremendous opportunity.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun to do the workshops. One of the highlights of my year.
Yeah, that's got to be. So the Coverts Project, you can go to our Facebook page. I think we've got it. We may already have it up, Cheyenne, but check and see it. If it's not, put it up on our Facebook page. We'll have it up there for sure. Let's turn to Fred in Rice Lake next. Fred, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Great show. I've got a question about that avian bird flu that's been present in the domestic turkey populations in Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Yeah.
Can that spread into the wild turkey population in the two states? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Fred, I am not a wildlife disease expert, but as you said, for the domestic turkeys, they are being hit particularly hard in Minnesota, especially with the bird flu. And my understanding is that mostly it's the wild waterfowl will carry the bird flu, so they can be a carrier, but they actually don't get sick from it. And then as they shed their feces or defecate, then that's how it gets transported across the landscape, where other birds get infected as they come in contact with that feces. And so, for example, if a waterfowl will defecate and then somebody tracks that feces into a domestic turkey flock, then it can spread that disease. My understanding is that wild turkeys, I'm guessing, are probably not susceptible to it. They are susceptible to other diseases like Newcastle's disease and things like that, but they typically would not be susceptible, I don't believe, to bird flu.
I can imagine why the caller from Rice Lake. There's a lot of turkeys, domestic turkey operations in that area, Barron and Rice Lake.
Yep, but apparently Minnesota is the number one domestic turkey producer in the country, so they are especially
really
being hard hit right now.
Yep.
Greg in Arborvita, thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, I got a problem here. Maybe not, but I want some questions and got some answers, I hope, from you guys. I got a pair of ermines.
Yep.
And then they're weasels, right?
Correct.
And they turn brown in, after the snow goes?
Yep.
And white in the winter.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, I believe I have a couple. One has a typical black tip on his tail.
Correct.
And the other one has a little bit of yellow past the black.
Yep, that very well could be. So there are three weasel species in the state, long tail, short tail, which are also referred to as ermine, the only one that we refer to as ermine by common name. So short tail, long tail, and then the least weasel.
All right.
And all of them turn color in the winter.
They'll turn brown after the snow goes, right?
Correct.
Okay. What is their life expectancy?
Good question. They are a carnivore, so they're feeding on small mammals, and just by the fact that they are a carnivore, or a predator, I should say, they have a little bit longer life expectancy than what, you know, a mouse or a small rodent would have. So I would say a couple of years, but I don't have anything in front of me to...
I had the enjoyment to watch this one. I was wondering, how do you distinguish from the male to the female?
So if I have that right, it's the male that is larger. The male is larger within the species, which makes it very difficult to tell the difference between a female long tail and a male short tail, if you're following.
Yeah.
So, the males are larger.
enjoyment of watching this one. We thought they were playing, but he killed a baby bunny.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was pretty amazing. We had to close the door.
Yeah. They're a really interesting animal, very inquisitive and pretty ferocious predators. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate your call. We had David in Milltown next. David, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, guys. I had a couple questions about salamanders I'm finding when I'm out nightcrawler hunting. And one is it's like black with blue spots on it. And another one I'm finding is kind of black with like red long stripes on it. And my questions are, what are those? And are any of them poisonous to handle or if a dog ingests them?
Yeah, so it sounds like, so there's about 7 or 8 salamander species in the state. And the ones that you're describing very well, sound like a blue spotted salamander and a red back salamander. Not very large by any means. Our larger mm-hmm. salamanders are the spotted salamander and the tiger salamander. None of our salamanders are poisonous, but it is something that after you handle them or if you choose to handle them, perhaps help them across the road, that you're going to want to wash your hands when you're done.
Yep.
Yeah, and the other thing is they've got this kind of a mucous membrane on their skin that protects them. So you want to be careful about handling them because you don't want to remove that mucous membrane from them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if you do it with wet hands, yeah. That's a way to protect that membrane.
Thank you, David. Appreciate the call. And Bob in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I had a question about generally how worried do homeowners have to be about their cats with the red foxes in Madison? Now, we had a cat, 8.5 pounds, not real big, but big and fluffy because long hair, had 3 interactions in the past couple of years with a fox, and twice late at night, I mean, in the evening, once in daylight, once at like 9 o'clock, foxes had come up and approached her on a leash, and people in either in a car or on bicycles came and chased the fox away. But in those instances, it seemed like the fox was coming up maybe to attack the cat. But last Wednesday night, I saw the cat cross the parking lot, was not on the leash, and there was an animal across the street, and I thought it was a raccoon. I could see the eyes, so I walked up there with the flashlight, and as I got closer, I saw it was a fox, and I was worried that the fox would attacked the cat, so I started running and hollered at the cat. As soon as I did that, this not really large cat just took off like a rocket directly across the street at the fox and chased the fox about 50 or 75 feet. The fox ran across the street around a house, made a U-turn, and took off, and then just sat about 30, 40 feet away, and then the cat just calmly walked up to me. So I was just shocked, thinking at any minute the fox would bite the cat. But
the other way around. Okay.
Well, Bob, I would be remiss if I didn't start off this answer with the fact that you should not have your cat outside. And it sounds like you may have it on a leash, but if you do not have it on a leash, if you don't have control of your cat outside, please refrain from putting it outside because cats are very destructive to our native wildlife here in Wisconsin. But with that being said, fox are pretty curious and pretty playful animals, and not to say that they wouldn't possibly eat your cat, but they also could be coming up just to investigate, and as you kind of relayed, that the fox is running away from the cat, so I'm not sure your cat has too much to worry about. But we are not doing diet studies with our project here in Madison, but surprisingly for fox and especially for coyote that are in cities, that they maintain a pretty natural diet. So even though they may opportunistically occasionally take a domestic animal like a cat or a dog, that the vast majority of their diet is still what you'd find them eating out in the country, and that would be rabbits and rodents and things like that that they typically would eat in the country. So it's not a bad idea to be vigilant, especially since you've seen the fox in the area typically, and the fox certainly is coming up to your cat. I would be very vigilant about that. Again, I would keep your cat inside if you can, but if not, I would be outside and have control of your cat so that you can protect it if the fox does decide to actually become aggressive with the animal.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an email from Deb in Owen Park that's in Madison. While raking up leaves and ground cover under a large Norway maple, I raked up a pile of twigs in a crook between the roots, and I found an egg. It was slightly smaller than a chicken egg, looked as if the twigs had been carefully arranged. What could that be?
Well, we had a chance to look at this one during break, so we were kind of scratching our heads and coming up with some, you know, plausible explanations, anywhere from maybe something else dragged the egg and put it there, but it sounds like there's more of a developed nest. So, you know, there's a lot of turkeys in that area. It's potentially a turkey egg. However, we would suggest that a turkey egg is a little bit larger, so more chicken size or larger. So turkey's a possibility, but even you know, ducks, which would have an egg of that size, typically have a, you know, a down-lined nest, so a nest bowl with grasses and down. But, you know, they've been known to nest in different odd places. So those are some potential guesses. There's not a lot of birds that have eggs that where they're nesting on the ground in an egg that size. So maybe there's other listeners that have some ideas, but given the size of the egg and the location on the ground, those are our, kind of our best guesses to toss out there.
And we had caller Duane from Park Falls wonders if fox squirrels are still present in Wisconsin. If so, are they native to here? He saw them 25 years ago at his brother's dairy farm west of the Dells. Hasn't seen any since.
Yeah, so fox squirrels and gray squirrels are both native species to the state. Fox squirrels cover the entire state with the exception of maybe the northern counties, the very northern tier of the state. And I was just home in Sheboygan County over the Easter break, and we see lots of fox squirrels in the backyard. So they do not... they're in the woodlands, but they do not prefer woods that have a dense understory that makes it more difficult for them to move through. So they're not as common as the gray squirrel would be my guess, although we probably don't have a population estimate for either species. But certainly we still have fox squirrel, and they're distributed primarily through the entire state with the exception of the far north.
We have some pretty cool photos up on our Facebook page. One comes from Tony, a Eurasian widgeon with a red head. He's got a photo here, present at Schoenberg Marsh at the Madison Audubon Society's Ørsted Prairie, along with many other species, including American widgeons. So he also comments, or Tony also comments, wildlife professor Joe Hickey wrote in 1955 that the best place in the Midwest to find Eurasian widgeons is at Goose Pond in Arlington, Wisconsin. On average, one Eurasian widgeon is found every 2 years in the state.
Yeah, this is a phenomenal time to be out birding. So Goose Pond, excellent place. The Nine Springs.
Eway,
yeah. Horicon, just some fabulous birding right now. And we plug Wisconsin eBird all the time, but go to the website, Wisconsin eBird, and look at where the most recent sightings of rare, unusual birds or large quantities of waterfowl. And go for a drive. It's going to be a beautiful weekend.
And somebody wanted us to remind people that the bird count, the Midwest annual crane count, is on the 18th.
Okay, coming up on Saturday.
Yeah, so
a week from Saturday.
They still need volunteers, Jerry says. So go to the annual, I don't know, the Midwest Crane Foundation, or the Crane Foundation is probably going to have all the information you need.
Yeah, and it looks like the link, he's provided the link too, so we can go in there and you can get signed up.
Yep, you get signed up right there. And then there's another picture taken in Stoughton. Two found very close to each other. But are they starlings? Are they?
No, I don't think it's starling. It looks like a some type of a blackbird species, maybe a brewer's blackbird.
Yeah, a starling would have a yellow bill, narrower.
Yep, and it's not as prominent of a bill, but that definitely looks like a blackbird
species
for sure.
So it's dead, and it looks like it's partially exposed breast there.
Yeah, yep.
No idea.
Yeah.
I really have no idea, but it's an interesting photo for sure. Connie in Middleton had a question for you guys. Hi, Connie.
I have a question about raccoons, because I have a small pond, just one that my husband and the sons dug out a few years ago, about 20 by 25. And we have a terrible time with raccoons. I only have goldfish in it, but I don't like to put them in just to have them feed the raccoons. My question mostly about the raccoons is do they actually swim in the water, or do they just walk as far as they can walk?
Yeah, they're very comfortable along the shoreline of the water. Certainly would swim if the motivation was strong enough, but they're certainly going to wade into that water. I mean, they commonly eat crayfish and frogs and other amphibians in the water. So very common along the shoreline, or comfortable along the shoreline. I'm sure they would swim, but not without cause.
Yeah. They also will go into the water and wash their food.
Right.
So that's another reason that they're attracted to water, in addition to the food sources that might be there in the water for them.
Yeah,
my brother
don't...
lost his black lab went into the water after a raccoon. The raccoon went in the water and then drowned the dog.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, they're a feisty animal.
Yeah, and when they get out in the water, they have a much advantage over a dog.
Yeah.
Right.
So there you go, Connie. Thank you. And we have Kathy and Ladysmith. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been listening, and it was interesting, the conversation with the fox and the cat. Hmm. We have had that in the past, and our cat would play with the fox. And there were times we'd separate, you know, for fear the cat was going to get hurt. And then one day, the cat wasn't acting right, took it to the vet, and it had picked up the mite from the fox that causes mange.
Yeah, so...
And, Kathy, you bring up a really important point, and that is, you know, these encounters that seem, you know, interesting and fun, and there's tons of stuff on YouTube about wild animals interacting with domestics. There is that risk, and that's the other reason to keep, you know, your cat indoors, is there's a risk to that animal being outside and in contact with wild animals that cannot be vaccinated. So while your cat gets all the vaccinations and veterinary care indoors, you're making it susceptible to things like external parasites and other diseases that wild animals can carry. So, yeah. And some of which can be then subsequently transferred to humans. So mm-hmm. best, safest cat is probably kept inside, given the roads and predators and diseases.
Well, the average lifespan is about half.
Right.
Outside cat is about half
of an indoor. Yeah,
that's correct. Indoor. So there you go.
Thanks, Kathy.
We had an email about a month ago from Lisa in Appleton, who said about a month ago there were two smaller and younger looking turkeys in my yard that would be chased relentlessly by the larger group of turkeys. What was going on? If it was about a month ago, those are probably not young turkeys.
Yeah, not young turkeys, but they might have been a late brood, so they weren't as large. So the young from last year were a late brood or a litter, so they might just look smaller than kind of some of our earlier nesting. So it might have been a re-nest attempt on a failed first clutch of eggs. So that those poults look smaller. But certainly the hens, the ones that typically do not have a beard, will be smaller in body size than the males, right. The toms. So, but they're in mixed flocks.
And as to why they'd be sharing them, they would be chasing them because...
Yeah, they're starting to establish breeding rituals and starting to figure out status amongst the flock.
And boy, are they doing that in Madison. Everywhere you look, there are turkeys and...
Yeah, actually, the youth hunt starts this weekend, I believe, for turkey hunting.
Yeah, I'll be out there with my daughter, actually, this weekend. So. Yeah.
Well, good luck.
It'll be beautiful weather.
It'll be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. We'll be spending a little time outside, and we have a place that I think might be just turn out to be a pretty good place.
You care to share that place, Larry?
Guys, thank you so much. David Drake and Jamie Knack will be back for sure. It's always wonderful to have them with us. They're with UW Extension. David is, and is also Associate Professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie Knack, Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening in. Looking forward to having you stay with us all afternoon, because there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, thanks for listening.